This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on, saber-rattling ourselves into war, Iran crucial facts and ignored options with Professor William Beeman.
But first, has the U.S. lost its dominancy as a world economic power? What are the cumulative effects of the current debt crisis, the depreciation of the dollar, and global peak oil? Are these factors just leading us into a recession, or are we heading into a long-term crisis that will significantly affect our living standards?
And we're joined to speak with Kevin Phillips, author of Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism.
Before we get to the substance of the book, although this really evolves out of the book, you were the senior strategist for President Nixon's 1968 election campaign. And at the same time, your book, Bad Money, or some of your writings have been said to parallel that of Harry Magdoff, who is a Marxist theorist from Monthly Review magazine. I'm just interested in how you actually politically place yourself at this point.
Well, I don't know. Magdoff, is he still alive?
No, he passed a few years ago, actually.
Yeah, I would be surprised if he thought we paralleled too much. I think what I have is a view of the role of finance, which doesn't come from any kind of Marxian analysis, but which comes from a mix of historical analysis with elements of American populism. But also, there's attrition in the Republican Party that produced lots of people who didn't agree with Wall Street economics, the progressives in the period from Teddy Roosevelt's day up until the 1930s with La Follette. Even John McCain, I don't support him, but he's got a lot of nasty things to say about Wall Street.
In your most recent book, Bad Money, you take a view that's a lot more pessimistic than a lot of people in the long run. What's the role of finance and all of this? Why are things getting so bad?
The central problem, and it's a problem that most of the media really doesn't want to discuss. They don't even want to publicize statistics that there's just no question about them. Finance is now the largest single component of the private sector of the United States economy. It's 20 to 21% of GDP. Back in the 1970s, manufacturing was 25 to 27. Financial services were only 10 to 12%. You've had a reversal. Manufacturing has dropped down to 12%. The rise of finance means that the United States, at a point in time when its global economic leadership and strength is really being drawn into question, is holding itself hostage, in essence, to the emergence within the U.S. economic structure of a run-amok sector. I cannot for the life of me understand, especially why people in so-called liberal and progressive politics don't want to raise these issues. Possibly one of the reasons has to do with the fact that the financial sector is now giving much more of its money to Democrats than to Republicans, largely, of course, just because they assume the Democrats will have everything politically. But they're right to think that it has a little bit of effect in anesthetizing Democratic commitments and conscience.
You use the term financialization, but there really are a lot of progressive, indeed Marxists, who have talked for a long time about the U.S. economy moving away from what really creates wealth, which is a manufacturing base, to essentially the takeover of the financial industry, which doesn't create wealth, as a significant problem that would indeed lead to a crisis of capitalism within the world community. So maybe you can tell us more about your concept and your term, financialization, so we can understand that in the context of your forecast of the crisis.
While we're doing profiling of the antecedents, I'm serious. The antecedents of some of these attitudes. You mentioned the left. I can mention, for example, on the right, the Austrian school, some of the libertarians who just go berserk over the Federal Reserve Board. And then in the middle, you have this loose populist and historiographic tradition, which just reacts to the growth of power and it's taking advantage of things. So I think to be skeptical of this actually has a multiplicity of bases, which I think is quite important if we're going to achieve anything. It's an enormous danger to the country. And to the extent that the neo-Marxists say this, the extent to the which the Austrian economists say it, the libertarians, just ordinary populists, fine, because it's a dialogue that needs every bit of help that it can get because the power structure doesn't want to touch it.
Now, we've been through the dot-com boom in the 90s, which saw a large increase in the financial sector, and then that led into the housing bubble, which we're feeling the effects of the bust of right now. Is this just going to lead to a bad recession, or is there something else involved in terms of how it affects the U.S. economy?
You probably have a major structural change coming that will follow up the huge unrecognized structural change that's occurred in the last 25 years. I mentioned the change in the shares of GDP, but there's another way to put it. If you look at total credit market debt in the United States back in 1987, this is all the tradable debt, all the stuff that could go through markets. It was about just shy of $11 trillion. At this point, and this was true in 2007, so let's make it 20 years, you're looking at something in the neighborhood of $46, $47 trillion worth of credit market debt. The extent to which this structure has been set up to the enormous benefit of the small percentage of Americans with money has produced all these imbalances, and because it was done so quickly, so recklessly, it has all kinds of problems. It has bad data, bad financial engineering, bad integrity. This is going to produce a series of fallouts in the American economy probably for 4, 5, 6, 7 years. I think we probably have roughly that to go just in the housing component, because housing recession cycles, when they're severe, generally last 5 to 7 years.
Kevin, I want to parse out some of the things that you deal with in bad money. One of them we've just kind of touched on, which substituting finance for manufacturing is. And another one is where you talk about America's play in oil and its tying of the dollar to the price of oil. What significance does that have?
Well, this is another frightening tie-in, which gets too little attention. We've stressed our currency and our global interrelationship with debt, and that's been one of the causes of problems in the dollar and the growth of inflation. But a second cause of problems has been a double whammy coming out of the relationships of oil. The first relationship is that oil has been enormously important to the United States in its history. Oil and what it powered put the United States ahead of the rest of the world. We were the biggest producer and the biggest exporter for a long time, and that started to change in the last 20 years. And bit by bit, we've gotten to the point where we produce only about a third of the oil we use, and it costs us now between $400 and $500 billion a year to import the oil we need. So the relationship of oil to the U.S. economy has no longer been a building block of the strength of the dollar. It's been an albatross of pulling the dollar down. And we've started to see the emergence in the financial markets of what I would call the currencification of oil as well as gold. Gold has been a currency substitute for a long, long time. Oil hasn't been. But as the United States moves towards this very, very difficult position vis-a-vis oil supplies, and this ties into peak oil because there's a growing sense that in many countries the supply of oil has peaked and that production won't be able to go up much in coming years and it will probably plateau globally within 10 to 15. This creates another problem in terms of the role oil will play, and these roles are starting to work against the United States both in geological terms, the availability of oil to support this country, and in dollar terms, the connection between a strong U.S. oil position and the strength of the dollar. It is now a negative connection. This administration is absolutely clueless. I've never seen anything as bad as this. I don't hold out a huge amount of hope for the next administration, regardless of party, but they'll have to go a long way to match these people for incompetence.
Well, now that you've brought out the people that are in power and those that want power, how do you see the politics of getting out of the situation? Do you think either the Democrats or the Republicans have a clue?
Well, I think some of the Democrats have some clues. I think Obama probably understands this as well as anybody. The difficulty is that I went to Harvard Law School, and Harvard Law School breeds an elitist viewpoint among liberals, conservatives, everybody. It doesn't breed a commitment to the ordinary people at the grassroots that's just instinctive. That doesn't come there. And I think he's comfortable now being tied more to the power structure. So I have my doubts. As far as the Republicans getting back in, they're not remotely prepared to deal with these issues. They haven't discussed them. I don't think many of them understand them in the Democratic Party. Some have discussed them somewhat. Some understand them. But I haven't seen them willing to discuss any of this.
I know that certainly in the last 20 years has been a quadrupling of the debt, $43 trillion or something thereabouts. But is there also a suggestion from you that people like the Federal Reserve Board Chair Alan Greenspan, folks like that, were really cooperating in the dilemma that we're in?
I think they were cooperating. I think they had a view of U.S. economic policy and U.S. economic statistics, which were also, in my opinion, somewhat manipulated, that all this was controllable and that you could let these asset bubbles develop and you might have to deal with them in a difficult way, but you could manage them. Greenspan, I think, is going to be remembered, and I think he's afraid of this now, pretty negatively. The notion of the maestro, you know, other words now come to mind. I don't think it's going to be flattering. Now, there are plenty of others who deserve to be tarred with some of the same brush. The people from Wall Street and some of them, like Bob Rubin, who was a Treasury Secretary under Clinton, he went for a lot of the same pie in the sky. Wall Street has been very, very supportive of all of this. They've loved the fact that they're the only industry in the country that gets bailed out almost no matter how crummy they are. You've got all these banks and investment banks that produced all this garbage, these financial products, and they take them into the Federal Reserve and they basically exchange them for a U.S. Treasury notes and bills. There's no other industry in the United States that can go into a special federal agency and exchange its flawed products for perfectly acceptable products. Suppose you were in the lumber industry and you had a bunch of warped boards. What would you have to do with them? No government agency is going to give you good boards for warped boards. Somebody's going to come in and take office in January next year. If you have to seriously propose far-reaching legislation, you have got to start discussing some of these things. Otherwise, the interest groups will know your ticket is not punched for putting that stuff through. The Democratic programs in housing reflect to a considerable extent money from the housing industry as well as other parts of finance. The Republicans will shamelessly bail out finance itself, but the Democrats have a history of being very open to bailouts in the housing sector because they purport to be worried about ordinary folks. In point of fact, I think they worry about some of the interest groups too.
One of the things that you also speak to is the corruption that has tainted the measures that shape the public perception of the economy. And you go into the consumer price index and the gross domestic product. And I just want you to flesh out more for us how that is utilized as a way to lull the American public into a sense that perhaps we're approaching a recession, but my goodness, certainly to divert them from anything more substantive as to downfall of the economy.
And let's throw in the unemployment rate into that also while we're doing it.
The big three in economic statistics out of Washington are the CPI and other inflation measurements, the unemployment numbers and the gross domestic product numbers. In both inflation itself, the CPI, and in the gross domestic product numbers, you have mismeasurement of inflation is part of what some economists call a Pollyanna creep. And if you go back 30 or 40 years in American statistics, you see the presidents from both parties have done it. It wasn't all done at any one time by any means. They just tried to put a happier face on things. They tried to find the part of the numbers that were more upbeat. They established as the norm one of the low measurements of unemployment instead of the higher measurement, which is like the one they use in Europe. They published that, but the media always ignore it because it's not the one that's sort of certified by the government. The CPI has been doped up the most and with the most consequences, and certainly with the help of both parties. As a result, you don't see the issue coming up in Congress, but you certainly see it in the financial community. More and more people are starting to discuss it. Different measurements of CPI and how if you use the old measurement that existed before 1980, our inflation would be about 10%. The fellow that's about the biggest bond manager in the United States, Bill Gross out in California, basically says the government has cooked the books and that the inflation numbers are a good bit higher. You know, why are we the only country with 3 to 4% inflation when the rest of the world has 7%? The answer is we're not. We've got the doctored numbers. And what's starting to be realized, if all of this sinks in and starts to become a big factor in the financial markets, all of a sudden you're going to see more weakness on the part of the dollar, more demands for higher interest rate, more unwillingness to believe that the U.S. GDP is still in positive territory, because if inflation is 5%, then our GDP isn't going up anymore. It's going down. But, of course, they say it's only 2 point something, so their numbers yield a happy face statistic. The government does a lot of shabby stuff, but this is right up near the top of the poll.
Well, I want to thank you for opening, these are really your own words, but they absolutely are accurate, opening a window to wider economic and political understanding. And if you, listener, want that wider understanding, I strongly recommend Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism by Kevin Phillips, who we had the pleasure of speaking with. And I thank you very much for taking some time to join
nice to
us.
Talk to you.
Now, William Beeman is author of The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullah, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. He joins us to discuss whether the U.S. will support terrorists to destabilize Iran and will revved-up rhetoric push us into another Middle East war.
Now, saber-rattling ourselves into war, Iran, crucial facts and ignored options. I wanted to ask you, first of all, about this congressional resolution on blockading Iran. I don't know if too many people have heard about this, but if you could comment on that.
I certainly hope that all of your listeners will pay very close attention to this. This is House Concurrent Resolution 362, Senate Resolution 580. This resolution is a frontal attack on Iran. It's filled with lies, half-truths, misrepresentations of the Iranian situation. And it was authored by the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee, was fed directly to Congressman Gary Ackerman from Long Island and Mike Pence from Indiana. Unfortunately, it has achieved nearly 200 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. Many of the representatives, as they've been contacted by their constituents, have expressed real surprise at the content of the resolution, which they never bothered to read. It calls for actions which are tantamount to a declaration of war. Although it has no force in law, it could be used by the Bush White House to justify a military attack on Iran. I urge all of your listeners to call their representatives and urge them to withdraw their support from this bill if they've already signed on as a co-sponsor and to oppose it in the House. Right now it's in the House Judiciary Committee, and the question is, will it emerge from the House Judiciary Committee? If it does, then yes, indeed, it will come up for a vote on the floor.
William, tell us more about the salient features and potential consequences of a bill such as this.
It has no force in law. but it sounds very much like the kind of material that was going through Congress just before the United States invaded Iraq. It's a way of boosting support for some kind of direct action against Iran. It's a kind of slippery slope. If you have senators and representatives who are on record as having voted for something like this, then when a serious authorization for military action comes before the House, they're going to have an extremely hard time voting against that, having voted for this very, very extreme sense of the Congress. So in an election year, this creates a kind of a one-way street for people in the House of Representatives, and that they don't want to be accused of having flip-flop on an issue like this. The entire resolution is full of mischaracterizations and really terrible inaccuracies about the Iranian situation. For example, the resolution takes as given that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. In fact, nothing has ever been proven to demonstrate that Iran actually has a nuclear weapons program. But it starts out with that premise. The National Intelligence Estimate in December of 2007, our official intelligence estimate, declared that Iran did not have an active nuclear weapons program at present, but this bill automatically assumes that it does exist. It claims that Iran's missile testing is in violation of United Nations resolutions. That's not true. There's nothing in the resolutions that prohibits any nation from engaging in normal military operations, which is what this is. It claims that Iran aims to destroy Israel. There's never been any declaration of that sort made by the Iranian government or by any Iranian official, including Mr. Ahmadinejad, who has never said he wants Iran to destroy Israel. He has no power to make that happen anyway, but nevertheless, that's what's claimed in the bill. So these are extreme statements that are designed to inflame the public sentiment. They have no basis, really, in any kind of an accuracy regarding the Iranian situation. And as such, it's extremely dangerous legislation because you're getting Congress people to vote for something that is not true. And then they're going to have a very difficult time explaining themselves when a more extreme statement, if the White House asks for legitimization for some kind of military action, they're either going to have to reverse their position and explain why they voted for something that was untrue to begin with, or they're going to have to go along with this more extreme position with the White House.
Now, Iran tests some missiles, and we go bonkers. I mean, Israel conducted full-scale military exercises about a month ago, and people sort of said, well, they got to do what they got to do. Why is Iran such a hot spot with the United States, with Israel? Why is people jump out of their skins when Iran does anything?
There's been a systematic campaign to demonize Iran. It's been going on for almost 30 years, but in the Bush administration, it has increased in an exponential fashion. There are a large number of people that we identify as neoconservatives, somebody like Kenneth Edelman. We know that since the beginning of the 1990s, this group has targeted Iran for regime change. And we have organizations in Washington, think tanks, namely the American Enterprise Institute, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and the Hudson Institute, that have been involved in a publicity campaign to demonize Iran for the American public in an extensive manner. There is a publicity agency, the Benador Agency, that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to get this message across to newspapers, to news outlets. You have individuals like Michael Rubin and Patrick Clawson appearing on even the public broadcast system to try to essentially present Iran in the worst possible light. We have neoconservative Nicholas Burns, who is Undersecretary of State in the State Department. His job during the entire tenure that he was there, and he'll be still in office until the fall of this year, was to essentially denigrate Iran. Every time something positive would happen with regard to U.S. actions in Iran, it was Nicholas Burns' job to immediately run out and tell the press that the Iranians were lying, or that what happened didn't really happen, or that despite the fact that Iran seems to have done something positive, the United States still disapproves of their actions. This has been so systematic and so consistent that it has been awfully difficult for the American public to get any kind of correct information about the situation. There's a systematic pattern. Every single time that Iran and the United States start to develop some kind of cooperative relationship, something that would actually work on the diplomatic front. There are countervening forces, both within the U.S. government and also abroad, primarily Israeli sources, that try to sabotage that operation.
You assert that the United States is supporting terrorists trying to destabilize Iran. Who are these people and what are they doing?
U.S. support for ethnic separatist movements in Iran has been longstanding, but it has increased significantly under the Bush administration. There are a group of people who, again, want to see regime change in Iran at any cost. They have gotten it in their head. Again, one of the places that I point to in an article and would direct anybody to is the American Enterprise Institute. They've held several meetings, both public and secret, in which representatives from these various ethnic separatist groups are brought to Washington and talk about the viability of their movements. The idea is that somehow these movements could be beefed up enough with U.S. support that they would actually cause an overthrow of the current government. This is so far from a possibility. It really strains any kind of credibility. Unfortunately, the people who are promulgating this idea have an extremely superficial view of Iranian society. They look at Iran and they look at Iraq and Lebanon, and they think that because there are a lot of ethnic groups in Iran, that somehow Iran is just like Lebanon or Iraq. It's not at all. The ethnic communities in Iran have been living together for more than 2,000 years, as opposed to the ethnic communities in Iraq and Lebanon that have only been living together since those nations were created out of whole cloth by the French in the case of Lebanon and the British in the case of Iraq. The groups are very dangerous, nevertheless, not because they're going to overthrow the government of Iran, but because they create a danger for the United States and also for the region. One of the groups, the Mujahideen Khalq, the MEK or the MKO, took part in the original Iranian Revolution, and they were ousted because of their Marxist views by the clerical establishment about 6 months after the revolution. They took up residence in Iraq, and they have been there ever since. They were supported by Saddam Hussein, and they are despised by the Iranian population because they were supported by Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. They have no chance of ever establishing a leadership position within Iran. Nevertheless, they have been supported consistently by the U.S. government. They've met with the Department of Defense, and they have congressional supporters. Senator Sam Brownback in Kansas and Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Lehtinen of Florida are two of the great supporters.
What's the best place to go to read some more about this?
Well, thank you very much. My book that you cited is a very good place to start. I also have a website that has most of my writings on these topics, and it's www.wbeeman.com. You can find that material right there.
So start reading The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs by William Beeman. Professor, thank you for joining us.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.